title of my presentation, see, it's Homo criminalis. In biology, it's common to have a common name for animals of species, and also a Latin name. Homo criminalis means criminal man. Criminal man is not those guys out there who are burglars or robbers and so on, but it's a perspective on man. So it's all of us in our role as potential criminals. So what I'm going to try to do today is basically answer one question, a theoretical question. Does optimal foraging theory help us understand how offenders commit crimes? And there's immediately a warning, because I'm a psychologist and I'm talking about biology, mainly by reading about biology, and you're an audience of mathematicians or criminology. So, little Babel over here. So, what I'm going to do today, this is the outline of my presentation. I'm going to talk very briefly on some biological perspectives in on crime and delinquency, because clearly optimal foraging theory is not the only one perspective that has been used from biology. And then I'm going to talk a little bit on foraging theory for those of you who are unfamiliar with it. It's a specific theory on how animals behave in order to get their food. So foraging has also been used more metaphorically as a kind of word for fuzzy search, but in biology it has a more strict meaning. And after that, the main part of my talk will be on applications of this theory to behavioral patterns and property crimes. So first, biological perspectives on crime and delinquency. There's a history which is started centuries ago, which links some physiological factors, hormonal factors, neurobiological factors, or genetical factors more recently, to distinguish people who are offenders or are likely to become offenders and those who are not. This is a branch of biology that is used, but it's not the way that I'm going to use. It is mainly used to distinguish people who are offenders from those who are not. Another important application of biological theory that has been used in criminology is the plant ecology approach that has been used by people who are involved in the Chicago School, Shaun McCabe, mainly Park, for example. What they did is that they used concepts and mechanisms found in plant ecology to the distribution of populations in large cities. When you look at areas where plants grow and so on, there's a certain succession. So you have one time it starts with sometimes some kind of flowers, and then there will be in time others that take over. And these processes have been used by Park and people in Chicago School to understand the patterns of succession of population groups in the Chicago and other large American cities, start of the previous century. And there are also two branches, more recently, evolutionary psychology and human behavioral ecology, that are used in criminology. And this is basically the approach that I will follow here in the presentation. And it's very similar to the work that Marcus has recently done in Crime and Nature, his new book. Actually, there are two or three chapters in the book on foraging theory. That I will also use in this presentation, because it's been very helpful. Once I started reading in biology, people came immediately, I think within a month after the book was published, to say there is a new book by Marcus Feltz, and read it, and of course I did. So, optimal foraging theory. What are the questions that are answered in this theory? Basically, well, there are some pictures in this presentation. I will tell you when the picture is important. Sometimes it's just an illustration. How do animals search for food? What do they eat? Where do they eat? How long do animals stay in a pitch? And basically, it's all about all factors that affect feeding behavior of animals. Maybe surprisingly, as it seems from outside, that this is a question that could have been asked for centuries ago, really systematically these questions have only been started to answer I think 30, 40 years ago, at least in the way that's presented here in terms of optimal foraging theory. So a systematic approach to how animals actually feed is only quite recent, even in biology. when we're talking about optimal foraging theory, which is the most important theory that's on foraging, we're talking about two elements that are central in the theory. One is optimization, and optimization consists of decisions, accuracy, and constraints. Basically, it's a concept developed in economics. And it's about natural selection in biology. So the assertion in the theory is basically that when animals feed themselves, they do it optimally. And why would they do that? Because natural selection is the way that by which optimal strategies survive.
Question on that?
Yes.
Is it optimal or just better than everybody else?
It is, in the theory, it is optimal. So in optimal foraging theory, I'll come back to this later, it's not amongst competition within species or between species. It's basically, given a certain environment, what would an animal do to optimize?
Okay.
Natural selection, that aspect of the theory I will not use today. It's somewhat more difficult, and actually we don't really need it to explain criminal behavior. You could use it. You could, of course, say, well, some non-optimal ways of criminal behavior will soon die out because the offender is easily arrested and so on. But basically, I don't think we need this aspect of the theory, this element of the theory, to use optimal foraging theory. So I won't further talk about it, and just to talk about the optimization part of it. So if there's three things, decisions, what to do, what are the alternatives, there's a currency, and there are constraints. The decisions that animals have to make are, what should I eat? How long do I stay in a patch where I can find the eat? And where do I actually search for food? There's also, for optimization, a currency needed. What are animals after? Of course, they're after food. They're also after water, but this is, I'll talk about this a little bit later. The most simple models in optimal foraging theory basically say that what animals do is that they maximize their expected energy gain per time unit. So they want to have a maximum nutritional value in a certain period of time, per hour or per minute, and so on. This is a very simple model, and I will go later on about extensions, because what animals do is apparently not only maximize their nutritional value, but they also have to survive. They have to defend themselves, and they have to mate and other types of behaviors, so there will usually be a trade-off. In the most simple models, it's simply maximize nutritional value per time unit. There are also a number of constraints in the theory. The most important one for modeling is basically that you cannot eat and search at the same time. So either you eat or you search for the next piece of food, for the next item. Doing it simultaneously is usually not allowed. And the most another important constraint is that everything takes time and energy, searching as well as handling prey. So when an animal tries to eat something, he has to split it up, work on it, and so on, or he has to capture it, eat it. And everything takes energy and time.
Are you doing herbivores or carnivores?
Both. I'll also come back to that. There is some difference in the behavior, but not so much. Basically, optimal foraging theory is about all animals. It's about from ants to lions to fish and so on. But there's some difference, of course, in extension. Let us start with the most simple model that we can develop, which is basically on optimal diet, or what should an animal eat when he encounters it. So you can imagine that the decision is basically, if I encounter something that I can eat, how should I do it or not, depending on the type of food item that it is. Again, the currency is here just to maximize long-term average rate of energy intake, and there are also constraints. One is, I mentioned that already, you cannot eat and search at the same time. Encounter is a Poisson process, so it's a stochastic progress with fixed probability of encountering an item per time unit. And there are some factors are exogenous, so you can't do much about time and energy it takes to eat a certain item. when you encounter something and you don't eat it, that does not cost energy and so on. And the most important one in this respect, and the most restrictive constraint, or maybe most unrealistic constraint in a sense, is that animals have complete information. This is not to say that they know where everything is, but they know how the world is encountered. So they know the encounter rate, how often they will encounter prey and so on. And they immediately recognize prey when it's there. So I'm going to do a dangerous thing because I'm talking about one thing, animal foraging, and I'm trying to apply it to criminal behavior. And still, I'm introducing another analogy just to get a feel of what the theory is about. Imagine you're at a conference like this, or maybe an even somewhat larger one, in your junior stages of your career, and you want to talk to a lot of people. For instance, in a geography conference, you would like to Brantingham, to George Rangers, and all those other people whose names have been there for a long time. And there's a reception, and you go about, and you walk along. And what you want to do is you want to spend your time as best as possible. So you want to spend some time talking to people so that they know you. And you go along, but you don't know who is everywhere. So you walk along and you have to decide, oh, I see George Ringer over there. Shall I talk to him? Is he important enough for me? The reception is a limited amount of time, so it's only an hour. Or should I just walk on, wave my hand, and go to somebody else, because I have to walk, it takes some time. I could go to Kate or to Michael, whatever. So
I would take you for breakfast.
This is, you're going on, time is limited, and you have to make those decisions. So you can get a little bit of feel of what's going on, and it's I'm getting ahead of the next thing. There's also a question, of course, of once I'm talking to somebody, how long should I stay talking before I hop on and go to somebody else? So when this model is worked out, and I'm now not going into the mathematical details because I wouldn't present formulas and so on, but the important thing here is that there are three important rules that come out of this model when you model it mathematically. First rule is that given a prey type, you either always choose it or never choose it. So you won't walk along and sometimes take this and sometimes not take this. Either you take it always or never. That's the 0-1 rule in this model. Now, how animals go about the decision of whether a certain prey is profitable for them, whether you choose it or not, is basically that all types of prey that they could possibly eat, they rank it according to the profitability of energy per time unit. So there may be a very very nutritional item, but if it's very difficult to eat, then the animal may move along to someone that's more easy to eat, although it provides somewhat less energy. And the prey types are ranked according to the rank order. So the most profitable items are ranked high, and the other ones are low. Whether an animal eats a certain prey item does not depend on the encounter rate. So if it's there. So if there's a lot of food that you really do not like, you will not just take it because there's so much of it. These are three important rules that come out of this model, and the question is whether we could use this in an application of how offenders choose targets. For example, the question of what to steal and specialize, and what to specialize or not. Basically, what I'm saying is that here we have a few hypotheses that, as far as I can see, have never been systematically, or some of them have not systematically been tested. One first hypothesis is that target choice can either be broad or selective, but it's basically constant. So items that are taken always or never. If a burglar goes into a certain house, he will take this or that, television or whatever is around. If he goes to the next house, he will not take something else. I mean, it could be that the load becomes too much. I'll come back to that as well. But basically, he has a preference for certain items and not for others, and those are consistent. Items are further ranked in terms of profitability, for example, on the basis of what is being called crave by Clark. Which you could help me out. It's concealable, for example. It's you can move it. It is small, like money, and it's valuable. So there are certain items that are for property offenders very useful because they're easy to carry, concealable, easy to trade, and have a high value. And property offenders could be expected to rank these items and decide on whether to take that or not on the basis of profitability. It would also imply, this model, that a high availability of low-ranked items does not create any demand. So property offenders will not steal cups of coffee if they're standing there and dictating, because simply they don't want them. If you get a lot of items that are stealable but they're not attractive, that won't change their behavior. So what they choose depends on the availability of higher ranked items, but not of lower ranked items. You can also expect that when opportunities for stealing highly ranked items decrease, for example, if portable computers are highly ranked items because they are, well, of course they are portable and they are valuable as well. If it becomes more difficult to steal those items, then, or in general, all items that are profitable, you would expect that offenders become more versatile, so less selective in the types of items that they want to steal. Basically, I think most of these hypotheses has not systematically been tested, although there's some circumstantial evidence that it works. Another question that is dealt with in optimal foraging theory, and it's basically linked to the whole model, is the decision, how long should I stay in a certain patch? So if you have patches of or places where animals go to find their food, there's usually the foods get less the longer they eat. So there's a certain moment of time in which you get less out of the patch. Again, here the model is based on the same type of constraints, like the decision is now how long should I stay in the patch, but the currency is the same and the constraints are also the same in this process. One additional constraint that was not in the previous one is the negatively accelerated gain function, basically meaning that there's resource depletion. So the longer I stay there, the less I get out of every minute I stay longer. Again, here's the analogy with the conference. I can talk to Lucia, but the longer I talk to Lucia, the less I get out of our conversation. So there's a moment in time when I want to go on and talk to somebody else. Sorry, Lucia. Optimal foraging theory here has a well-known marginal value theorem, which says I should leave a patch, so a place where I can find the food, when the marginal rate drops to the average in the whole habitat where I live, somewhat vaguely defined, basically, what habitat is. Say, everywhere, or it could be my awareness space, for example, if we go ahead to the analogy. Yes, please.
Are you imposing any constraints on the derivatives of these functions? Like, for example, they have to be smooth in the first and second derivative?
So yeah, well, in the first, at least, second, yeah. I mean, the gain function is basically decreasing derivative of first order.
But it's smooth,
Yeah, that's right, and it's smooth. So every function in these models is smooth and continuous. It's really very basic. Marginal value theorem says you should leave a patch with a marginal rate, so whatever you get out of this conversation or of this food item, is fixed amount of interesting talk or nutritional value per time unit. Another implication of the model is at the time of exit, the marginal rate in the patch is the same for all patches that you visited. And also that you stay longer in a patch, so in a place where you find the food, when the travel time between the patches is longer. So if there's a long amount of time between this patch and this patch, and you have to travel in between, you will stay longer in every single patch. So this is a figure that took me about 2 hours to understand, but it's very common in the behavioral ecology in optimal foraging model. There was still here it is. What the figure basically shows is here the gain function. So this is the cumulative energy that you get out of staying in this patch, and the longer you stay, the more you eat there, but per additional time unit, it decreases. So apparently there will be a moment in time when you leave. That moment in time will depend on the travel time, which is here on the axis, which is the encounter rate, 1 divided by the encounter rate. If travel time is relatively short, you end up here, because here it touches on the gain function, and you will stay. It's the green one. Yeah, you will stay T1. So this is the time that you will stay, say 20 minutes. But when in the area, the travel time between between patches increases, so this point goes that way, then it will be more steep, less steep, and it will touch somewhat later. So you will stay longer in the patch to get your food. Yes,
I'm having trouble with something here. The animal is at one patch of time at a particular time. It hasn't been to the other patch yet, so it doesn't know how far away it is. Moreover, if the animal had been there before, they would have eaten something, so they constantly have to be updating information based on something they haven't seen yet. I don't know, how does the animal anticipate how far to the next patch?
The animal knows lambda. He doesn't know, it's a stochastic process. He can be sure, maybe it's 5 minutes, maybe it's 20 minutes, but he knows on average, don't ask me how he knows, on average he knows, the model says on average he knows how often he will find a new patch. This could be learning over days and months for it.
So it's some kind of aggregation of a past experience that if I wander 10 minutes north-northeast, I'm going to find something that's better than what I have now, given the marginal rate.
With a certain probability that it depends on this.
Okay.
This number, yes.
The simplest models just assume some sort of global understanding of lambda, but also the variance of this model that he's basing on updating and some sort of memory length, and they work approximately the same way.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why you talk longer to boring persons in the MTO section.
I thought that was good
match. We learn something every day.
Oh God, I didn't know what I started. Okay, let's go to criminal men and see what this would mean for behavior of offenders. Well, in the first place, I guess it means that they will stay longer in places that are more profitable. Say let's make it somewhat more concrete and say that we have a burglar who is going around burgling, and that we're talking here about patches as a house that's being entered. So this model can also be used, but I'll give another example. If it's a rich house, if there's a lot to steal, he will stay in there longer. If it's in a rural area and it's basically farms where he's burgling, then there's a lot of travel time between the places that are available for burglary. So in each one he will stay longer on average. I'm not talking about the police and the people who live there, so it's another issue. And also they will still stay longer if the access time to get into that patch or into the property is higher. So it's more difficult to get in, they will stay longer within. That's the example of what we would expect for a single house. We could do the same model and use it on an area like a neighborhood, for example. In that case, we would say that a burglar who is using an area as a patch where he goes around and tries to burgle houses would stay longer in a place like Bel Air, that is very rich, than in a poor neighborhood. and also if the areas where he can burgle are farther away, so if the neighborhoods are farther away, he will stay longer in one neighborhood. So the optimal voraging theory applied to offender behavior can basically be applied in many situations. Whether it's realistic is another issue. But at least we have some idea or some start of hypothesis that could be tested. And basically, I don't know of any testing of hypothesis of how long offenders stay in houses or how long they stay in certain patches or areas or neighborhoods to commit their crimes. So this is basically hypothesis generating theory coming from optimal foraging theory. Optimal foraging theory includes something that is called central place foraging, and basically it's the application of everything that I've talked about before to a certain pattern of foraging, meaning that people or that animals come back to a central place. In foraging, the most common example is birds who feed their young, and the only thing about foraging is getting the food and getting it to their young. So they have to come back to a place time and time again, which is not assumed in the previous model, because an animal can go along, eat somewhere, maybe sleep there, do other things, and come back. So central place foraging is about animals that come back to a central place where they have a nest or a place where they spend the night. Well, not spend the night, because then they're not foraging. So food is carried back to a central place. This has some, although it's very, all the rest of the assumptions and so on are similar, this has some important implications in travel time and in the amount they have to carry back, the amount of food they can carry back to the place where they come back. So it influences behavioral choices. The first rule is that animals will, in general, forage as close as possible to a central place, that's to their nest or to the anchor point where they have to come back. And second, there's a distance-size relation. So at short distance, generally, they will find lighter prey items. In the biological application, lighter usually means less nutrition. The larger, the more nutrition, the smaller, the less nutrition. And at longer distance, they will, from longer distances, they will take heavier prey items. They will also stay longer in more distant patches because of travel time, and their diet will be more selective in distant patches that are further away from the anchor point. I'm not going to prove all this, that's all the math that's behind it, but these are the substantive hypotheses that come out of this model.
On the return trip, does the model take into account the energy it takes, for example, to carry back a heavier, clumsier item?
Yes, it does.
Handling power. Handling time and handling energy loss.
Yeah. and it makes a difference between the way to the play and the place back. There's some hypothesis there, and contrary to what I said before, there's also some evidence in data from criminology for the hypothesis that come out of this model. Well, this is of course a bit more for the math people in the audience than for the criminologists in the audience. The distance decay function is a very well known empirical fact in criminology. And it relates the distance from the home of the offender to the frequency of offenses. And there's a clear decay function there. I'm not going into detail about whether there is a buffer function, so whether offenders are somewhat less likely to offend close to their homes and somewhat further away. But in general, the distance decay function is one of the most corroborated findings, I guess, in environmental criminology. Somewhat less corroborated, but also found by some people, is that there's a relation between the distance from the home of the offender and the proceeds of the offense. This has been found long ago for robbery by some people whose name I forget, but also by Janssen and van Koppen somewhat more recently, and by Brent Snook much more recently for burglaries. So it's not as overwhelming as the evidence for distance decay function, but the distance gain function, there's also some empirical evidence in criminology. Bishop, do it again.
Yeah, just, I'm trying to understand the mechanism here. I mean, you got the John Dillinger problem, you know, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. If you live in a poor neighborhood and you're interested in burglary, you're going to travel. I mean, it doesn't, there's no optimization. It's, you don't have a choice.
It's a trade-off between distance and gain from those burglaries. If you can get some cash or something on your defense easily,
the version of this model has a homogeneous availability of the route.
But I mean, it's what I guess what I'm saying is that it's the reason, one of the reasons that looks that way is because of the background of the individuals who are likely to be burglars. You live in a poor neighborhood, you got no choice if you want to make a big strike to go far, right?
Yeah,
but if I live in Beverly Hills, I go next door.
Burglary different. Just a simple thing. People with more money do not usually have more cash. They may have more jewels, but there are some problems. You can't be sure that higher income households have a better burglary tape. And remember also that a lot of electronic goods are stolen, and as your income, if your income is four times someone else's, you don't have four times as many electronic goods.
Anyway, where the the model is derived from a situation where there's randomness in the distribution of the target. So, I mean, you're right that that specific assumption need not be true in the case of offenders. So this function could, I mean, there are many possible distributions of targets in a home location that could possibly give rise to such a distribution without a specific gain. Function. That's basically true. Yes. One of the interesting things, by the way, is that there's at least for the distance decay function, maybe also for the distance gain function, there's an interesting discussion in behavioral ecology whether this is really an individual function, whether for a single offender it would be true that most of his crimes are committed close to home and a few further away, or whether this should be as an aggregate, and exactly the same discussion is going on in my township. You know, will be writing about that in the book that's to appear. So exactly the same discussion is going on in criminology and in behavioral ecology. I didn't realize that before I started reading behavioral ecology, of course. So the models thus far, I have to stop at half past.
That's including this.
It's including it, yeah.
I suggest you take 7 minutes.
I'm just, that's right.
10 minutes.
thus far, the models are, basically quite simple and basically quite restrictive and only taken into a. They have one currency. The only thing that animals want to do is optimize nutritional value per time unit. So they have a single currency. Obviously, that's too restrictive because evidently, their utility is a trade-off between the nutritional value, but also travel time, well, that's included there, but also hydration, and more importantly, the risk of predation. There are always other animals who are foraging and want to eat you, and you have to take care of that, otherwise you won't live and procreate and so on. So if you're an animal, you cannot only maximize nutritional value, it's a simple model, but you have to take other things into account, and obviously, behavioral ecologists have taken that into account. So optimal decisions would mean that you imply multiple criteria for deciding what is basically optimal. There's an important shift here in behavioral ecology because you move from a priori prediction, saying I can count what the nutritional value of this specific item is, and so I can exactly predict what the animal will do, towards a posteriori currencies, reasoning from the behavior that I see, I will infer how important is this criterion for the animals. I mean, this is very common in the economics and most of the social sciences, but it's a step, the next step in behavioral ecology. So, just look at this picture to get an idea of what this is about. Here, there are a few different currencies involved. Basically, what you have is a distance. This is your nest, and these are patches where you can forage. And these patches are somewhat different, not only in terms of the food that is available, But there's also some differences in the type, in the amount of water that's available, something you need, and how many predators are around. That's something that you don't need, you don't want. So, where would you forage? This one has a lot of food, some predators, but no water. This one has a lot of water, only one predator, but just a little bit of food. And well, this one has a lot of predators, a little bit of water. So you have to make a certain trade-off. And also, there's of course also distance involved. So this one's nearby, and I'm talking now about someone, an animal that has to go back. An interesting framework that could be used here, and that I've used previously to model criminal behavior or criminal target choice, can also be used here, which is a discrete choice framework. Well, it's basically a model that has been developed by McFadden in economics to model discrete choice. He won a Nobel Prize for that, even. Well, not only for that, of course. And the model says, so when you have to choose from a certain number of alternative, and each alternative for each individual I, each alternative G, yields some utility. So in the utility in some specific application, like the one that I showed on the previous slide, would be depend on food, water, predation risk, and the distance from the home location, and some random error to make the model, a probability model can be statistically tested. So food, water, predation risk, and distance are decision criteria in this model, and the parameters, they can be estimated on the basis of behavior and then give some indication of how important that criterion is for deciding on which pets to choose. So we could make this, say, numerical and give values to the food items and so on, and then estimate on the basis of the behavior, not of a single individual, of course, but of a number of individuals, animals for that case, but also for criminals, because what you could do is say predators is an analogy to the police who is around, and well, water could be an analogy to something else. So you're basically talking about criteria that offenders use in deciding how profitable a patch is, and you could test this model. We've done this, I'm going somewhat more quickly, on residential burglary, looking basically at a number of areas in the city of The Hague, 100 areas, about 100 areas, and looking at the behavior of offenders who were arrested and see where did they live and where did they commit their crimes. And we had some assumptions on which areas would be attractive for offenders. Well, of course, for every offender, proximity to the home address would be something different, but for example, affluence and so on, we expected that would be more or less the same for all offenders, and we allowed say ethnic heterogeneity of the area to be different, of different importance for as a decision criteria for non-native versus native offenders. Mm-hmm. And we also assumed that proximity could differ between minor and adult offenders simply because minor offenders would not have motor vehicles, and so would be less mobile in the area. So just to show, maybe not to go into the details of the model itself, just to show that this basically is a way to look at a foraging model and estimated with a regular econometric model, is that you can indeed, what you can do is that you can estimate the attractiveness of certain areas by their characteristics, but also including proximity as an individual measure. So that's, although each neighborhood may have a different distance to the location of the offender itself. So this is a way to include the type of distance decay function into a normal model of offender behavior. This is about the difference between these young and old, native, non-native. I'll skip that. I'll go back to something that was mentioned before, and it's about social, or refer to something mentioned before, social foraging. All the models thus far are assumed that the animal is just on its own maximizing its outcomes. Well, not alone, maybe they're predators, but he has no basic competition among for resources. So there are what I call Robinson Crusoe models. social foraging is a much newer area of in optimal foraging theory, and it's based on the observation that animals often forage in groups, and that there's competition amongst animals, and sometimes also cooperation. So in these models, there's a switch from optimization to equilibrium. So they basically use game theory to model these situations. And I was interested in whether we can learn a lot about crimes, offender groups, collaboration, proceeds, and so on by looking at models from social foraging theory. Unfortunately, I don't think very much. And why is that? Basically, cooperative foraging, like we think that, or that would be an interesting aspect to study in criminal behavior, is really very rare in animals. There's some cooperative foraging in lions, in bees and ants, and some animals, but even if there's cooperative foraging, it's a lot about cheating, stealing, and so on. So basically, there's not much cooperation amongst individuals. Animals. So foraging apart together is basically the rule. It could be interesting because the same processes could also be amongst offenders, but basically I think when we try to explain how offenders work together, the sole focus on competition that is used in these models is not very useful. Of course, offenders steal from each other, they cheat and so on, but this is not the basic thing that we're trying to explain. We would like to try to explain cooperation rather than competition. So I may be completely wrong, but I didn't find any models in there that would be very useful in social in social foraging theory, that would be very useful for explaining collaboration between offenders. So I'm wrapping up more or less. The question would basically, would optimal foraging theory fit or not fit property crime? Well, okay, these are some other, well, let me go very shortly in this. So I'm still saying why, basically, additional reasons why social foraging theory would not fit in so well. So basically, the first one I already mentioned. Competition could be useful, so optimal foraging models could be useful in some aspects of criminal behavior. And basically, I think in those types of behavior where competition could play a role in illegal markets, like in drugs dealing, prostitution, and so on. So it's an interesting theory, but not very useful in explaining causes and effects of cooperation and property offending. This is what I already said. So I'm really wrapping up. Is optimal choice theory very different from rational choice theory? This is one question when you start reading all this work that it comes to mind, if you know rational choice theory, that is basically very, very similar to the Woodman-Schumann in rational choice theory, with the one sole exception that maybe rational choice theory assumes somewhat about consciousness and purposeful action that is not assumed at all in optimal foraging theory. So it's not assumed that animals consciously do all these things. It's basically a model of how they would behave if they would be optimizing, because they think, well, that's the only way that the species wouldn't be there if it wouldn't be optimizing. So I think the theory is very similar to what we already have used in criminology, that's rational choice theory. Another important distinction is that animals must always eat or otherwise they die, but humans may choose not to offend. They have alternatives. So basically, we can say that when we try to model offending behavior, we use optimal foraging theory, we do as if the offender must always offend, and that's not always true because he has other alternatives, and animals do not have those alternatives. So that's where somewhere you could say I can use optimal foraging theory, but then I should also include legal alternatives that offenders or would-be offenders also have. So that's the limitation of the application of optimal foraging theory to criminological questions. So my conclusion is basically that the optimal foraging tree is very useful to generate hypotheses and have some ideas of what could be important, but it should be applied with very much care. That's the main points that I wanted to make and bring to you, and I would like to discuss further on.